Even wars have limits, because wars without limits are wars without ends. Healthcare personnel and facilities are the outer frontier of these limits. My name is Devay.
And my name is Nivedita. Welcome to Ampule, the flagship podcast of the Australian Medical Students Association, where we bring you conversations with leading experts on healthcare issues shaping our world today.
Join us as we discuss quality healthcare in conflict zones with a special focus on the Ukraine crisis.
We're joined today by our special guest, Elise West, the Executive Officer of the Medical Association for Prevention of War. Before turning to medical activism, she worked as a journalist, documentary filmmaker, and field producer in Central and South America, where she covered conflict and post-conflict stories. She has also volunteered for, worked in, and managed civil society organizations in Northern Ireland, Guatemala, and Australia.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Hi, Elise. Thank you so much for joining us, and I'm really looking forward to learning more about you and your organization, the MAPW. And before we jump into that in more detail, I'd love to get your thoughts on the Ukraine crisis, which I think is front of mind for a lot of people when we talk about healthcare in a wartime setting right now. With the scale of this conflict, two heavily militarized nations fighting on a front line that seems to be stretching for thousands of kilometers.
The WHO has already reported 218 attacks on healthcare services in Ukraine. What impact are these attacks having?
So you're correct. There are 218 attacks have been reported on healthcare in Ukraine. I suspect that that number's incomplete. For context, the WHO is mandated to monitor attacks on healthcare in complex humanitarian situations like war and runs a surveillance system for attacks on healthcare. This system surveils all attacks on healthcare across the world, and I think it's really important to note that this year alone, the WHO has recorded attacks on healthcare in 14 territories worldwide, including Yemen and Syria and the occupied Palestinian territories. I think it's safe to say, again, we are probably getting underreporting on these numbers. The types of attacks that the WHO monitors are things like violence with heavy weapons, the militarization of healthcare assets, obstruction to healthcare delivery. So that could be physically obstructing people attending a hospital or a clinic, or setting up kind of administrative barriers. So that may be requiring people to present identity documents, for example, to get access. There can be the psychological violence and threat of violence or intimidation to prevent people accessing. I think something to be aware of as well is that there's the one of the types of attacks is the removal of healthcare assets. So that's stopping transports, interrupting supply lines, for example. And something that should concern us especially is the abduction or arrest or detention of health personnel or patients themselves, which can be very common. So you can see that, you know, not only does this destroy healthcare facilities themselves, but it prevents people getting the access that they require and kind of creates fear and barriers towards people seeking out the health care that they really need, especially under conflict situations.
I think you touched on this a little, but this was the first time on news, I think I at least saw during a war that healthcare facilities were being attacked, and my peers and myself were all very shocked by this kind of situation. So I was just wondering, are these attacks on healthcare facilities, are they unique to the Ukrainian war, or do you know of other situations where this happened before?
Sadly, they're not unique to this war. And in fact, analysts on this subject say that there is an increase of deliberate attacks on healthcare and the militarization of healthcare itself. There's another coalition called the Safeguarding Health in Conflict Coalition. They also run their own monitoring service. They actually report a higher number of attacks on healthcare. Over 2020, they identified 806 reported incidents of violence or obstruction of healthcare in 43 countries and territories experiencing conflict. So their numbers are a lot higher. So I think generally there is not necessarily an agreed measure or system to classify and monitor and record attacks on healthcare, but they are sadly a factor of conflict internationally.
Yeah.
I think I've always just thought of healthcare infrastructure as sort of sacred ground, and I think it's always been depicted as such in during war and sort of immune from being a wartime target. But given the number of attacks, it seems healthcare infrastructure has been specifically targeted as part of Russia's military strategy. Do you think there's any evidence of that at this point?
I'm not sure if that's clear at the moment. I think that will certainly be something that will require investigation. You're right, there's long-standing humanitarian principles to uphold medical impartiality. So that's the obligation and the right of doctors and nurses and other medical professions to treat anyone in need, regardless of politics. And attacks on health professionals and healthcare sites violate that principle. And they're also breaches of international law. So the Geneva Conventions of 1949 and the Additional Protocols of 1977 mandate the protection of medical facilities, the people who work in them, the patients who are being attended in those facilities, and also the humane treatment of civilians who are injured in war. So under international law, customary international law, intentionally directing attack against a facility or a zone set up to treat or shelter wounded and sick is prohibited. And there's a statute for the International Criminal Court that calls that, identifies that as a war crime. So if an attack against a healthcare facility or a zone is intentional or reckless, it does constitute a war crime. That I think remains to be established without a doubt, whether that has actually occurred in Ukraine. Yeah. I would say that attacks on healthcare are very difficult to prosecute, and there have been very few instances where they've been litigated in domestic or international criminal courts. Often the investigation falls to the perpetrator, which obviously doesn't necessarily produce a satisfactory outcome. There's an example from Afghanistan. So in 2015, there was a US airstrike on a trauma hospital that was run by Médecins Sans Frontières. The hospital's location and purpose was known to the United States, but nevertheless, the facility was attacked with aerial bombardment, killing patients and staff. Médecins Sans Frontières concluded that the attack was deliberate because the location was known and urged an international investigation. But what happened was the US military conducted an investigation into itself. And while it found that it had acted in error and had failed to comply with its own rules of engagement, that wasn't in itself a crime because the investigation ruled out deliberate targeting. And that's just an example of how difficult it is to prosecute a crime and to hold perpetrators to account. But I think this is something really where medical students and health and medical workers can really play a role in holding perpetrators to account. So the Safeguarding Health in Conflict Coalition that I mentioned before has recommended that the UN Security Council referred by Syria and Saudi Arabia to the International Criminal Court for investigation of alleged war crimes against healthcare. So Syria in the conflict in Syria and Saudi Arabia for attacks against healthcare in Yemen. I do want to mention here, AMSA, your organisation has joined in with MAPW and other health and medical college like the Australian College of Emergency Medicine, the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists to denounce attacks on healthcare in Ukraine and importantly wherever they happen. So it's extremely important that we don't have selective outrage and selective calls for accountability. All attacks on healthcare must be condemned and perpetrators must be prosecuted.
That's really good to know that we do have a role as medical students and healthcare professionals as well.
Absolutely, yes. And I think that's really comes down to the values that are core to health and medical work, that values all life and seeks to prevent harm to all people without distinction.
Yes, yeah. Just on that, at the moment on the ground, what do you think is being done by WHO and others to help alleviate the crisis in terms of, say, aid or humanitarian corridors, and how health professionals are a part of that as well?
All right. So, again, information is coming out from Ukraine from various sources, and I Again, I think that some of it would be incomplete. But the WHO reported on the 6th of May that around 12.1 million people are in need of humanitarian health sector assistance in Ukraine. As we mentioned, that is because of the destruction of health facilities and the total collapse of healthcare inside those conflict zones. Disruption to supply chains, cuts to power and water, interruptions to routine care. I think it's important to remember that, you know, in parts of Ukraine that are not in direct conflict, you know, life goes on for people. They still need their heart appointments. They still need their cancer treatments. And some of that really important care has been interrupted. There's a burden on neighbouring nations because of the sheer volume of people who have been displaced by the war. Mm. There's extraordinary stories of entire hospitals, you know, upping and relocating pathology labs and so forth, sort of re-establish themselves in basements. And as we mentioned before, that the fear of accessing health care because it has been targeted or people being displaced and kind of losing their place and losing their routine and so forth. So these are the kind of things that the WHO is reporting. The WHO is assisting with a lot of these issues, but I was interested to learn that around 60% of partners in the emergency health response are Ukrainian NGOs and health services. So there's an extraordinary mobilisation of Ukrainian health and medical workers to sort of serve their own people and their profession under these circumstances. I think some of the key health concerns are clearly the physical and mental trauma of, of war, of being displaced, of family separation. Gender-based violence is obviously of supreme concern. There's some data about access to basic medicines as well. So the International Organization for Migration conducted some rapid assessments, which means they just kind of survey people quite quickly and quite frequently to monitor some key indicators. So in April, they found that 85% of the people they surveyed said that the medicine that they needed wasn't available. It wasn't in the pharmacy, if the pharmacy was even open. And 44% of them said they couldn't afford the medicine in any case. So even if it wasn't available because of the, you know, the disruption to the entire economy, people just simply couldn't buy it.
Yeah. That's such a shame. That's a huge amount of people as well who are.
It is. And I think that it's a lot of people, but I think the numbers, you know, we have to look through the numbers to understand that these are a lot of individual people as well. Yes. Sometimes when we talk about, you know, 12 million people displaced or X million people refugees, we can become overwhelmed by the numbers. And I think it's important to sort of connect with the human dimensions of that group of people.
Mm.
When we hear about all this, I think it's just innately the desire to help. Do you think that resource support or personnel support is the most important at this point?
It seems to be a combination of both. The European nations have really mobilized. There's been financial support from outside of Ukraine. For example, Australia has contributed humanitarian aid as well as medical supplies. I think the combination of the two is really important. There's been terrific examples of attempts to provide continuity of care, for example, so entire hospitals sort of absorbing Ukrainian staff and Ukrainian patients. Medical schools, I think it's been really interesting, have kind of worked together to try and provide continuity for training for medical students. Mm-hmm. As you will know more than anyone, medical training is so incredibly resource intensive and a really valuable asset to society. So when you lose a medical worker, you actually, it's, it has significant flow on effects for the rest of society over time as well. So I think some of those things have been really important. I read a great story in the New Daily newspaper about a Sydney doctor who herself was Ukrainian, who mobilised, you know, public hospitals and called up the airport and called up a logistic company and got a pallet of supplies together and sent it to her contacts in Ukraine. I think that's a really great example of how a medical fraternity can kind of work together to respond to crisis.
Just going back to the health issues in Ukraine and how you're talking about people still needing their heart medications, for example.
Mm-hmm.
One of the main health concerns, I guess, worldwide now has been COVID. So we just found that Ukraine reported its highest daily COVID case count on February 10th, and that was just 2 weeks before the war began. So question to you is just how do you think the war has disrupted COVID-19 management for in Ukraine?
Well, the connection between conflict and infectious disease is really well established. For example, in Syria, there was a resurgence of measles, even though there had been no outbreaks prior to the war. Yemen has suffered cholera outbreaks, again, when there had been no cholera present before the war. Mm. So, yes, COVID-19, there is a concern about increased transmission and a reduction in vaccination. As you can imagine, all those kind of normal health systems are disrupted. People are displaced, there's crowding, etc. So all the factors are present for increased transmission. I think that those neighbouring host countries, with support from national and international organisations, are playing a key role in containing outbreaks. But I think WHO is also reporting that there's a risk of measles. So Ukraine has had a significant outbreak in 2019. And by the start of this year, immunisation coverage was still quite low, like well below the recommended coverage.
Mm.
I think it's also important to note that more than 250,000 Ukrainians are living with HIV, and about half of those are taking daily medication. Ukrainian civil society and public health organisations are leading extraordinary efforts and taking great risk to deliver medical supplies and HIV services to people on the front lines of the war. And tuberculosis, I think, is also another concern. So Ukraine does have one of the highest rates of TB in Europe and is known for quite high rates of drug-resistant TB. And the war is expected to continue to impact on treatment and treatment outcomes. As you'll know, that like untreated or interruptions to treatment in things like TB can lead to kind of changes in the disease profile and can have quite significant kind of long-term effects.
Yeah. And do you think this is being exacerbated by people having to take shelter in close quarters?
Absolutely. Yes.
Because I think we've all seen the stories of people hiding in the Kiev subway stations.
Yes, correct. And I think this is true of all conflicts where people, flee their living structures and, and gather together. Also, if you have interruptions to water and power and heating and sanitation generally, levels of sanitation decrease, which will contribute, to the increased transmission.
And I think we touched on the current increased disease burden. Do you think the hardships that people are going through today, the lack of access to healthcare, the progression of chronic conditions, do you think this will have a significant impact on health outcomes long term, perhaps decades in the future, long after hopefully this war has ended?
Well, yes. Yes, I believe so. So first of all, you have this massive damage to Ukrainian infrastructure, not just health, but its general kind of civil infrastructure. It's not clear when the war will end. It's not clear when populations will return. It's not clear how much diseases, for example, will progress or worsen during that time. I should also point out that Ukraine is also servicing kind of massive foreign debt as well. I mean, I think it's just really, it's really clear that, war is just so devastating to people, and you have the kind of acute immediate consequences, and then you have the long tail of consequences. People's emotional and mental health can be significantly damaged. There will be a very, very long recovery. And in fact, societies never really fully recover, I think it's fair to say. The trauma of war lives in people, in their minds, and in their bodies, in their societies, and is passed on down through generations. So it's not just physical health, but it's also the kind of social and mental health as well.
Yeah. I know earlier we were talking about how there could be a disruption in the flow of, I guess, medical personnel as well as one of the impacts, and how they are trying to really continue medical education, but that that could be disrupted to some extent, which I'm just thinking into the future, that could mean like a shortage of healthcare workers in Ukraine. And with more healthcare problems that we've talked about so far, it seems like they might be under-resourced in the future. And I was just wondering, do you think there's a role for, I guess, foreign medical personnel or aid even to help in that situation?
Yes, there may be. I suspect sort of in a post-conflict period, there will continue to be the presence of international organizations like the WHO, like the UN refugee program. They won't all just disappear on that day that the war formally ends up. But yes, I do suspect that there will be a long-term role.
And just to wrap up this section, it seems sanctions have been a major component of the pushback that Russia is getting on this war. And I think there's also been mandates within the US and Europe for their companies and their pharmaceutical companies not to provide and sell things to the Russian domestic market. Do you think that's a viable component of the anti-Russia campaign, or do you think that it's something that should be kept exempt from sanctions?
Well, now sanctions. So MAPW, generally speaking, we are leery of sanctions. Sanctions ultimately affect ordinary people. You've mentioned about supply of medicine, for example. Over time, you see a pattern where sanctions are applied in order to pressure a government to change its behaviour. Ordinary people cannot access food and medicine, and the government doesn't change its behaviour. So there's not necessarily a good stock of evidence to show that applying sanctions changes a government's behaviour. Applying sanctions may punish people and their governments, and it may create an opportunity for nations to sort of show their unity, for example. We're all going to sanction Russia, and therefore we all send a signal that we are of the same mind. Mm. But I suppose the question is whether they're effective and whether they take us closer to a solution. And I don't know that is entirely clear.
Now for a short break with a message from our sponsors. BOQ Specialist has worked closely with medical professionals for over 30 years and understand the unique challenges that you as medical students will face at the beginning of your career. You may find you need help towards your rising course fees, placements, everyday living expenses, buying a new car, or even saving up for your first home. BOQ Specialist offer a private banking experience and tailored products designed for medical professionals. We at AMSA recommend that you get in touch with them for a chat. They also have a podcast channel called Checkup by BOQ Specialist. Be sure to subscribe. Their first episode is well worth a listen as they delve into what to expect from your internship. For more information, visit www.boqspecialist.com.au/students. So just moving on to more about MAPW, because we've touched on kind of your viewpoints a few times, but I just wanted to ask more about that in particular. So could you explain to us what MAPW is essentially all about?
We are all about, we're part of the tradition of medical activism that addresses the social and political determinants of health. Yeah. As you and your listeners will know, there are things outside the biomedical model that affect the health of individuals and the societies in which they live. So we focus on the prevention of war. For all of the reasons we've been talking about today, we can see that, you know, that war is absolutely devastating and must be prevented because its effects are so extreme. Our mission is really connected to the WHO statement that the role of physicians and other health professionals in the preservation and promotion of peace is the most significant factor in the attainment of health for all. So this statement really shows how health in all its forms, so physical health and mental health and the health of the of our planet, and peace in all its forms. So when we say peace, we don't just mean the absence of war, but a positive peace that enables equity and justice, and all the aspects of human flourishing are really inextricably linked. And so therefore the inverse is true, that poor health and inequity and suffering and injustice are connected to conflict. So they can cause conflict and they can be the result of conflict too. It's easy to see this relationship when we look at somewhere like Ukraine or Afghanistan or Palestine or Yemen, but it's harder and but just as important to be alert to the fact that even before you get to the threshold of outright war, harm can be done from militaristic attitudes and practices. And by militaristic attitudes, I mean things like the misdirection of resources, so an overemphasis on defence spending, for example, and an underinvestment in actual human well-being. Another thing is the orientation of society towards militaristic values. And I would describe those as sort of patriarchal, paternalistic, intolerant of dissent and difference. The harm that comes from putting an emphasis on difference and competition and threat between nations, and especially now at a time in our history when we are in dire, desperate need of collective responses to some of the greatest challenges, like climate change, for example. So that's the kind of context that we see ourselves in here in Australia. So although Australia has been involved in many wars throughout time, Australia itself is not a conflict zone, but nevertheless, maintaining a focus on the prevention of harm that comes with militarism and, you know, and the path towards actual wars is really, really important. We take our roots are sort of in the 1980s. So this was really at the height of the Cold War, when the threat of nuclear annihilation was really extremely tangible. So I was a child in the 1980s and I thought that I would die in a nuclear holocaust. But I had a plan that if I didn't die sort of in the first explosion, I was going to hide under the kitchen table until I grew white fur, and then I was going to roam the earth seeking out other mutants. Like that was how it was for me as a child, that my future was like mutants. So around about that time, two physicians from the United States, one from the United States and one from the Soviet Union, recognized that they had a common obligation to prevent what can't be treated, nuclear war, for example. So they formed an organization called the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and brought together US and Soviet doctors to talk about this common obligation. And that's kind of the roots of MAPW. But we're also, you know, medical activism has a wonderful tradition. You know, Florence Nightingale is an activist. In Australia, I don't know if you know about Bugger Up, with the doctors in that movement, but this was a wonderful, wild movement from the 1970s, which was all about kind of refacing billboards that advertised unhealthy messages. There's also the Doctors Reform Society. They were formed in the 1970s to support the establishment of the universal health insurance system, then Medibank, now Medicare. Even though now it seems like Medicare is such an established part of our health system, back then when the idea was first floated, really wasn't quite so popular. So the Doctors Reform Society played a really, really important role in establishing Medibank. And today there's other organisations like Doctors for the Environment, Healthy Futures, and Doctors for Refugees. And then there are kind of innumerable other doctors and health workers who are champions for change for their patients and their communities around tobacco and harm reduction, reproductive rights, all those sorts of things. So we sit in that kind of tradition of medical advocacy, but our focus is on the prevention of harm caused by war.
Honestly, just hearing your stories about your childhood and hiding and death, I think we've all seen those kind of videos in school of like kids during the Cold War watching videos of just global annihilation. And it seemed a lot of, at least people in, I would say my generation, that that was a kind of a historic idea,
Yes.
relevant to like our present days. But like it seemed recently that we're now entering a new era of remilitarization. Like I think I heard even a lot of like Germany and a lot of these Western countries are re-emphasizing militarization.
Yes.
Do you think we're headed back towards a world like that, where those become more prominent concerns, or are those concerns that never left?
We would say that they never went away. In some ways, the nuclear threat was kind of normalized and integrated into military doctrine and the way that people thought about the world. I agree with you that, in response to, well, seemingly in response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, European nations have, increase their arsenals. There's new nations wanting to join NATO. Certainly, things aren't going back to the way they were in December 2021. Where they end up is really not clear yet. But I think, again, this is where health and medical voices are absolutely crucial to draw attention to the harm that's caused by overinvestment in militarization and underinvestment in human well-being.
I didn't know that MAPW had its origins in nuclear weapons and their prevention. Just going on from that, is that still one of your campaigns at the moment?
Oh,
What other
yes.
campaigns are you, I guess, working on at the moment?
All right. So, MAPW, just to talk about the nuclear issue, that is our core and abiding mission. And we're the founder of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, so ICAN, which won the Nobel Peace Prize
Yes.
in 2017. And I think it's really important to note that we do have the solution to nuclear threats from Russia or anyone else. And that solution is really born out of and rooted in the medical and humanitarian values of MAPW and organizations like us. This is the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which abolishes all nuclear weapons and removes the possibility of use and threat of use, which in itself is harmful, the threats. So we do have a solution, and together with campaigners all around the world, we are working our butts off to move the world towards a state where people can no longer be threatened with complete annihilation. So that's really important to note that there is a solution at hand. We don't need to, hide under the kitchen table yet. But there is a solution to the problem. So some of our other campaigns. Let me see. Unfortunately, we're really busy. You'd like to think we didn't have much to do, but as you mentioned, we are entering a period of increased militarization of society. So we are very busy. So alongside our work to abolish nuclear weapons, we have a campaign called Quit Nukes, which is a divestment campaign. Divestment is really about financial institutions ridding themselves of harmful investments. So we have been working with Australian superannuation funds to get them to divest from holdings in companies that produce nuclear weapons. We have another campaign which is called Aiming for Prevention. This puts a public health lens on the arms trade. You may not know, but Australia is a significant exporter of weapons, including to nations in conflict, where there have been credible accounts of grave violations of international law and significant effects on civilian populations. So I've mentioned Yemen a few times. The war in Yemen, the key partners in that, protagonists in that war are Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Australia has continued to export weapons to both those nations throughout the war in Yemen, despite the fact that Yemen is undergoing the world's most extreme humanitarian crisis. Happily, right now, a truce is holding there, but we've been advocating to the government for many years to cease exports to that nation. We think it is unconscionable that the Australian government would continue to approve exports given the humanitarian situation on the ground. That's one of the goals of aiming for prevention. We also have a campaign called Reclaim Remembrance. When I talked before about militarism, one of the sort of, I guess, signs of a militaristic society is that the use and distortion of history to promote and normalise war and conflict. We see this every year when Anzac Day rolls around. We kind of, especially over the past 3 years, Anzac Day has been accompanied by warnings that, you know, war with China is over the horizon, that, you know, we better get ourselves ready. We think that this is also extremely problematic. One of our key focuses of the Reclaim Remembrance campaign at the moment is to kick weapons companies out of the Australian War Memorial. So your listeners may not be aware that the Australian War Memorial, whose purpose is to commemorate loss, the loss of Australians in war, is currently advertising companies who profit from war, including companies who, including companies who profit from their production of nuclear weapons. This, you know, in itself is pretty wild. I think there's an analogy. Imagine like if a tobacco company was funding a cancer hospital. You know, it's that level of yuck. So that's one of our campaigns there at the moment. We also work to support whistleblowers and truth tellers. Particularly, this is in relation to Afghanistan. So Australia was in Afghanistan, in combat in Afghanistan for 20 years, and no doubt you heard about the Brereton report where there was the allegations of war crimes committed by Australian forces against Afghan people. We work with others to call for justice for victims of war crimes in Afghanistan. That includes perpetrators being brought to justice and reparations as well, but also to protect those people who have blown the whistle and told the truth about what was occurring in Afghanistan. So, for example, there is a military lawyer named David McBride who raised for many, you know, for a long time, raised concerns about the conduct of the war in Afghanistan and the potential that war crimes had been committed inside the military. And when he wasn't listened to, he took his concerns to the media and they were published in the media. And even though those concerns have been borne out by subsequent investigations, he still faces life in jail for revealing that information to the media. This is obviously really problematic, and this is something that we're quite active on as well. I could talk for forever about what we do, but I'll leave it there. You can check us out, mapw.org.au, and you'll discover what we're up to.
And would there be a role for med students to get involved?
Yes, there is absolutely a role for medical students to get involved. We have a pretty good relationship with AMSA, with the student union organisation. Mm-hmm. For medical students, I think one of the most important things to do on campus and in your own education is to be informed about these broader sort of social and political determinants of health, and I guess what we also might think of as the moral determinants of health. Medicine can be so transformative, but is necessarily constrained by some of these other kind of social and political structures that can reduce the good that medicine can do through things like militarism and through things like acts of aggression and war and so forth. So I think you can ask to be specifically educated about these issues within your medical degree and also within your activities, you know, say with the student union, the global health theme that AMSA works on, to also incorporate issues of war and peace. We would kind of say that these are kind of like the, you know, a mega determinant of health. We can't address climate change. We can't address health equity or any of the other issues that we care about if we are embroiled in conflict or if we are overinvested in preparing for war rather than investing in human well-being.
Yeah. It seems like it's becoming more and more difficult to just live in that isolation of just focusing on things that are happening in the hospital. seems like it's downstream of so many other larger and global changes that are happening. I think, like,
yes,
med students, the more we can get involved in that, I think probably the better.
Yeah. I think one thing that activism, you know, on any issue that you personally really passionate about, one thing that activism is really helpful in teaching you is how change happens.
Yeah.
And understanding what the role of power is in making change happen. Essentially, change is about moving power from people who have too much to people who have too little. And also understanding how the role of values, so connecting with the underlying shared and underlying values, is really powerful. And I think that's something that medical activism has in spades. You know, those core values are unimpeachable. You know, the care and respect for all human life, I think, is gold, is so valuable in making change. And yeah. Also, activism teaches you about how to convince others and how to bring others with you towards, you know, the change that you want to see.
Yeah.
So even just as a formula, a way of making change happen, small changes or big changes, they can be changes in your workplace or your life, or changes in your society. Understanding how change happens can be very, very powerful.
Yeah. I think that's a whole topic in itself as well.
It is.
But very interesting and good for us to have an idea of how, come out and like get a bigger picture of what we're doing day to day, how we can help beyond just the hospital, and what kind of outlook to take on it. Also, I just wanted to ask you a bit more about your career. I was reading through all that you've done, and it's an extremely interesting career trajectory. I was just curious, what made you get into medical activism, and wanted to ask about your journey regarding that.
So I studied history, and then I began to work in media, so making documentaries and current affairs for television. And a lot of what I was doing was seeing the results of conflict, either immediate or kind of long-term results. So, for example, in Guatemala, I volunteered for Forensic Anthropology Institute. So Guatemala had experienced decades of civil conflict, and as part of the Truth and Reconciliation process, there was a program of excavation of mass graves. And I volunteered as a human rights accompanier. Mm-hmm. So that was to be I guess the thinking there is that so there was a risk to the team that was doing the excavations, because obviously not everybody wants the truth to be told. So the idea was that if there was a foreigner in the team, then if something happened to me, that might draw attention. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. I dug holes in little Guatemalan towns and found skeletons of people who had clearly been murdered, often in the very towns in which they had lived. On one occasion, we excavated in a woman's backyard. She herself had been shot in the massacre, but she had pretended to be dead. And then when her neighbors came to bury everyone, they found her still alive, and that's all they could do. They had to bury them where they fell. So she lived with that for decades until the team came along and lifted up the bodies so they could be given back to their families. So obviously, you know, that something like that makes a great impression. And when I was part of a team that interviewed a Guatemalan military officer, and he was asked about the responsibility of the Guatemalan military for massacre, his comment was on the lines of, oh, if we had done it, we would have killed a lot more people. And, you know, this is really shocking, because the answer is not, oh, no, we would never do that. The answer is, you know, if we would do that, then, you know, the death toll would have been much, much higher.
Yeah.
So this, you know, you can't forget experiences like that. So, you know, since then I felt very passionate that, you know, war was just a terrible, terrible business. And the thing that really, really bothered me was that people profited from it. So they might, there was financial gain in the conduct of war, and that people sort of gained power and influence by conducting war as well. And I just can't stand it. I really, it really bothers me a lot. But it took a while for me to get to MAPW. So I continued sort of working in media and community media, but really developed my own advocacy skills and worked in organisations, kind of, you know, figuring out how you run an organisation and so forth. So when the opportunity at MAPW came up, I was like, this is my job. You know, this is the thing that I need and want to do. Yeah. So it is quite personal in a lot of ways.
It seems you've had a lot of very confronting and lasting experiences. How do you think that shaped how you do your job today?
Well, it makes me really satisfied to be working on an issue that I care about. It does feel like completing a loop in a way, moving from seeing the consequences to being active in preventing, you know, doing the sort of preventative work. Obviously, you know, I'm really aware of my privilege and my good fortune to not have experienced that myself, but I also feel privileged to have been able to understand it in some way, and that I've been able to develop a tiny, tiny little bit of insight. So I really, you know, I love what I do, and I think it's really, really, really important.
Well, thank you so much, Elise. Your convictions honestly are really inspiring, as well as your insight on some of the conflicts that we've touched on today. And I hope our short conversation can maybe inspire some of our fellow colleagues to get more involved in organizations like the MAPW.
I'm for sure we'll try and like see what I can do, if I can contribute in any way.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I know medical students have an enormous amount going on, so I really appreciate your time.
That's the end of today's episode on Ukraine's healthcare crisis. We hope you enjoyed it, and thank you very much for listening. Please follow us on Apple Music and Spotify. And if you do want to give us any suggestions, please contact us on AMSA's Facebook page. Looking forward to our next episode coming at you soon.